to tell you a little something else about myself, personally, that relates to the subject matter that we're here to talk about, which is failure. How many of you guys, by show of hands, have failed at something pretty significant in your lives? Oh, wow. Okay, good. That's very good. That's actually a good thing, and you'll hear in a minute. So I come from a big family of lawyers. My dad, you should live and be well, practicing law for decades. My brother's an attorney, my sister-in-law, my cousins, all lawyers. It's not a fun place to be around sometimes at the Shabbos table. Anyway, it was my turn. I went to law school. And I was also in rabbinical school. I was doing a lot of other things. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I was a wild, so you have to go to law school. And I thought perhaps that I would actually practice. For any of the Soviets in the room, I actually wanted to become a Sovietologist. That was my original interest, and I studied in the Harriman Institute for Soviet Studies at Columbia. What's that?
What a choice.
Yeah, and I was going to combine it with my law degree, and I was going to save the 3 million of our Jewish brothers and sisters caught behind the Iron Curtain, and I was very involved in it in high school, college, and graduate school, and then they all got out, and my whole career changed. But I want to focus on the law part. So I finished law school, I took the bar, and I will never forget the day that I got the results back. Now, I know people were telling me you have to focus, and I wasn't so focused, but, whatever. It's a test that everybody takes, and, no big deal. It was a big deal. I got the results back, I opened up the letter, and I looked inside, and I failed. And I had this terrible pit, like, in the bottom of my stomach. I remember that feeling. It was awful. And I didn't want anyone else to know. I don't think a Wilds ever failed a bar. And I didn't want, but I wasn't deterred. I was like, okay, people fail it. I'll take it again. I signed up for a different bar review course. I studied again. I took the test the second time. I got the results back. And I failed again. Twice. Now I was mortified. And I was like, the feeling that I experienced when getting those test results back, sharing it with my parents, I was just embarrassed. And I felt like a total failure, and that was it. There was no way I was going to do this thing again. And the reason I asked all of you, how many of you actually failed something in life, is because fear of failure is a major impediment to people of all ages from attaining their dreams in life. Many people fail, and because they failed, it really knocks them down so badly that they don't get back up. And I see it every day with people here at MJE, how fear of failure is a major factor preventing people of all ages, all socioeconomic groups, for little things like staying on a diet even, to tackling a new project at work or falling in love and getting married. Fear of failure is a major preventative in people reaching their dreams and goals, and this is something which is affecting younger people today more than ever. And I'll give you a study to demonstrate this. This is a study conducted actually by the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if you know, but they actually conduct their own studies. They reported on a study which concluded that startup companies by people in their 20s were at their lowest in like a quarter of a century. Down from 10% in 1989 to 3% in 2013, which means that the population that is most suited to risk-taking, people in their 20s, because you don't have a mortgage, you don't have a family you have to feed, you're old enough to start doing your own thing, but not so old that you don't have so many other people, relying on you. Young, healthy 20-somethings, unaccountable to spouses, children, or mortgages, lowest risk-takers in the last 25 years. The actual, the percentage of the largest or fastest growing group of entrepreneurs in the United States today are people in my age and up, 50s and up. Which makes no sense, because when you hit my age and, you want to try something else. I remember when I went to law school, there was this one guy who was older than everyone else, and I'm like, what are you doing here? And he was a doctor. And I said, what are you doing here? He said he was not happy. He went to medical school 8 years, like 4 years, and then and then he just wasn't happy. And I give that guy a lot of credit because he says, you know what? I want to still pursue. I'm interested in the law now. So he went to law school. So the fact that entrepreneurs, welcome. The fact that entrepreneurs in the United States are age 50 and up is not a good sign, because you want young people taking chances, because as we get older, we're about to go on a ski retreat this weekend. So this happens as you get a little older. So I was never a great skier. Okay, I was never a good skier. Okay, but as you get older, you know, you start getting a little more afraid that something could happen. Now, something could always happen, but when you get older, you start, I don't know, there's more people more dependent on you, you seem to matter more, and you take less risks. So I find myself, as I get older, like not wanting to hit certain mountains that I always skied down before. So the question is, what kind of wisdom does Judaism offer to help us overcome this fear of failure? Because I'm very much convinced that failure, and you'll hear in a minute why, is the only way to succeed. And if you talk to people of great success in whatever profession, in the music industry, in the law, in medicine, failure is really how you get to where you want to get. There are very, very few situations and cases of overnight successes. Even the overnight successes that we think were overnight successes were not overnight successes. It took years and years and years for that person to get to a place where they could sort of like pop out, you know, at some point. So one of the very opening verses of the Torah tells us, famous verse in the Torah, Vayi Erev, Vayi Voker, Yom Echad. And it was evening, and it was morning, day one. What's that talking about? It's in Genesis. And it was evening, and it was morning, day one. Creation, the first day of creation. What's the problem in the verse? Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Boker, the word Vav means and it was evening and it was morning, day one. Okay, the Jewish day starts at night, we see that in the verse, if that's what you were thinking about. What else is strange? And it was evening, and it was morning, day one. What day of creation is this?
What?
So what's
and?
There's
something before.
And implies something came before, but this was the first day of creation. What could come before? So the Talmud tells us, the Medrash actually says, part of rabbinic literature, in the name of Rabbi Avuhu, that milamed, to teach, shebara olamot vehechrivan, that God created worlds and destroyed them until he created this one and declared, this one pleases me, those do not please me. What? Did you know that according to our rabbinic tradition, the world that we're in today is not the first one, it's not the first one God created. He had a couple of tries at it. And he didn't like them. You know, it's like, what's that? So actually, it's interesting you raise that. Some people like to use this midrash to reconcile what seems to be a contradiction between science and religion, or science and Judaism, in terms of the age of the universe, then maybe what we're seeing in a world that looks much older than the Bible says it is, right, is that maybe we're looking at worlds that were destroyed. It's not a great answer. The simpler answer is that we don't really know how long the first 6 days of creation were, because we have no sense of them being 24-hour days until what comes into existence. How do we define a 24-hour day, actually? So it's the rotation of the world on its axis in relation to the sun. The sun doesn't come into existence, according to the Bible, until day four. So what was going on the first few days? How long were those first few days? It says it was day, it was then, but what does day mean without a sun? We only know a day meaning 24 hours because of the sun. But there was no sun until day four, according to the Torah. It's interesting. That's an easier way of reconciling. Anybody want to read this? Whole book written on this by, Gerald Schroeder, Genesis and the Big Bang. Any physicists in the crowd? Yeah, me either. But it's a very dense book, but he's a physicist, like an MIT physicist, and like a big believer in the Torah. And he kind of, you know, reconciles the two. Welcome. Okay, so this Medrash says what? The Medrash says that God created many worlds, and that's why the opening verse of the Torah says, with a vav. And it was because he had already created a bunch of stuff before. But what does that mean? Hashem's creating worlds before he created this one? I mean, God couldn't have gotten it right on the first try. When I was a kid, someone once made a cute line. They said, you know, when God writes, his pencils don't have erasers. Because he doesn't make mistakes. By definition, God is perfect, so he doesn't make a mistake. So why does Hashem have to create a world? Don't like it. Scratch that. Let's try it again. Let's go back to the drawing board. What's the deal with that? So obviously, God could have created everything perfectly on the first try. What the rabbis are saying is that this rabbinic teaching is imparting a very profound Jewish teaching, which is you're going to have to do things wrong until you get them right. And that by creating and destroying until the desired end is achieved, we are being taught not to give up when something does not come out the way that we really want it to come out. Thomas Edison, famous inventor, was once asked by a reporter with a little chutzpah how it felt to how did it feel to fail so many times before you built the alkaline battery? So you know what Edison answered back? Such a brilliant response. He says, I never failed once. I just figured out the 9,000 ways that don't work. He totally reframed his quote-unquote failures as necessary prerequisites for achieving success. The great Hasidic master, Rav Levi of Barditchev, I think Barditchev is in the Ukraine. Yes, I think so. He taught, I mean, that's where most of the great Hasidic masters were from, the Ukraine. The Baal Shem Tov, who founded the Hasidic movement, the Maggid of Mezrich, his student, Rav Zalman of Liadi, the Baal HaTanya, all from the Ukraine. Anyway, Rav Levi of Barditchev said, this is one of the things that an adult can learn from a baby. You ever watch a baby learning how to walk? Why is it the cutest thing in the world? They look like little drunk, fat people who keep falling down. And what do you notice about them? They always get up. Now, even a kid that doesn't have much of their, frontal, their brain developed, after some, just stay down. You know, you're just going to fall. But what he's saying is that somehow this child naturally intuits that he's going to keep falling or she's going to keep falling. They just have to keep doing it. And it's funny, it's cute to watch, but it teaches something very, very deep. Falling, failing, is the way we humans learn. That's how we learn. That's how we learn how to swim. That's how we learn how to walk. That's how we learn how to do the most basic things. And think about any, new position you ever took in the company where you work, in your firm, in school, what it felt like to do it in the beginning for the first time. I remember I once went to when my back went out after the MG ski retreat. I did. I herniated L5 on the ski retreat, and I started doing yoga. So I remember I went to this gym, and I was like, oh, yoga, it's nothing. I used to work out. I was like a basketball player. Yoga's going to be nothing. I go to the yoga class. I couldn't do anything. I was like, and people were putting themselves in these like contort, And it made me feel for the first time, it's like, this is maybe what some people feel like when they come to shul, to synagogue for the first time, holding the prayer book upside down, I don't know what page they're on. But it's, in order to start really getting into it, you have to make mistakes. So here's my question. I haven't said anything controversial or probably anything that anyone in this room disagreed with, probably. Very harmless, material we probably agree with. The question then is, why does it feel so bad to fail? If it's such an acceptable thing, if we're all so comfortable, as we are right now, understanding that failure is a prerequisite to success, then why does it make us feel so crappy about ourselves when we do fail? Why did I have that terrible pit in my stomach when I got the results from the bar? And so in order to answer this question, I want to take you back. little theology here to the Garden of Eden. You guys familiar with the Garden of Eden? Adam and Eve, a bunch of animals, a snake. You can enjoy anything you want, God says. Just don't eat from that one tree, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Right? And what do? They disobey God. Okay? Now, what is that called? We're going to call that original sin. Now, that sounds like a very Christian idea, but it's from the Old Testament. It's from the Hebrew Scripture. But the Christians call it original sin. We'll call it original sin too. According to the Christians, that original sin so tainted man that humankind becomes incapable of saving or redeeming itself. That disobeying God, it wasn't just simply God said don't do something and they disobeyed. Okay, it somehow reflected a certain fundamental flaw, according to classical Christianity, really Catholicism. And mankind is so incapable at this point of redeeming itself, they have to place their faith in a perfect being who does not sin, who can save them. Who's that perfect being? Of course, that's Jesus, who died for your sins, the Christians believe, like classic Catholic doctrine. And because you're now incapable of redemption on your own. Now, Judaism has a little bit different take. We also believe in original sin. It's our story. It's in our Bible. But what do we believe the impact of that original sin was on people? We say that there was an impact, and the Kabbalah has a whole discussion in Jewish mystical tradition. According to the Kabbalah, Adam and Eve, before they sinned, were on a very high level, almost like an angel. They were people with bodies, but the body was basically governed by the soul. It was like a soul with the body at its behest. There was evil in the world, but the evil was external to man, to people. And it was represented, according to the sages, by either the serpent or maybe the apple. I don't even know if it was an apple, whatever the fruit of that tree that they weren't supposed to eat. It was external. So it was bad, it was evil, but it was not within us. This is what Kabbalah teaches. When man sinned, when Adam and Eve ate from the forbidden fruit, what they did was they internalized, they brought that evil within. And so now humankind has got both a good inclination, which they had before, and called in Hebrew the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. There was evil in the world, but it was external to man. When we ate it, we literally brought it in. And now we've got like some conflict. Now we become complex beings with both good and negative tendencies. Right? The little guy with the halo. And by the way, different cultures and civilizations and philosophers, you know, in psychology, we'll call it the id versus the ego. There's the conscience, and then there's the more base part of us, wants to just do what makes us feel good. It's like the pleasure principle. But then there's the higher part of us. A lot of different systems have called these things different things. In Judaism, classical Judaism, it's the Yetzer Hara, it's the Yetzer Tov. Yetzer means an inclination, an energy that we have to do the right thing, our conscience, our ability to morally reason, and then there's the negative part, the more physical base part of who we are. But we believe that the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, can beat out the Yetzer Hara. Christianity, to this day, believes that mankind is so overwhelmed by the Yetzer Hara, by the evil inclination, that it has no chance, and therefore the only way that you can be redeemed from your sinful state is to place your faith in a being that never succumbed. And of course that's Jesus, and this explains who the Messiah is in Christianity versus Judaism. Christianity, the Messiah is Jesus. He's born of Immaculate Conception. According to Catholicism, even his mother Mary is somehow born free of original sin. Jesus is perfect. And he needs to be perfect because mankind is in need of his salvation, because mankind is so imperfect and so incapable of saving himself. Judaism's Messiah, very different. Who's our Mashiach? Who's our Mashiach? Does anybody know? We haven't seen him yet, so maybe that's why you don't know the answer. But who's he supposed to be? Supposed to be a descendant, a man, a person from who? from the tribe of Judah, direct descendant of whose line?
Ruth
and later David, King David. Now David was a great prophet. He was a great poet. He was a warrior. But by no means is he depicted in the prophets, in the Bible, as somebody perfect, like Jesus is depicted in the New Testament. David had lots of enemies. He had non-Jewish enemies like the Philistines. He had Jewish enemies like King Saul, who Saul felt threatened for the throne. He struggled with sin, if you're familiar with any of the stories, with David and Bathsheba. He had enormous challenges and obstacles, but he taught us that you can rise above your failures, you can rise above your sins, and you can become what's called in Hebrew a Baal Tshuva. We use that term in America, you know, today, Baal Tshuva, to talk about someone who wasn't raised religious and then they became religious. It's not really an accurate description. A Baal Tshuva is someone who does the Tshuva for whatever it is. A person could be a Hasidic Jew, a very Orthodox religious Jew, their whole life, and swayed in a certain area. You know, their Achilles heel. And then they, all of a sudden, they break through and they maintain their loyalty, their steadfastness to the halacha, to Jewish tradition. That Jew, even though he's fully Orthodox his whole life, is also a Baal Tshuva. Right? You can save yourself by doing what's called Tshuva. Repentance, whatever the word is, the word literally means to return. As we believe, and the Kabbalists teach us, that we have a very pure soul. And that pure soul is always with God. It originated with God. And no matter where we have brought that pure soul, it can never get schmutzed up. It's a pure part of who we are, and we could always come back to it. That's the Jewish view. Otherwise, you need a savior. Otherwise, you need someone who's perfect to rescue you. The best way that I could come up with to define or to clarify these two different approaches is through superhero characters. My favorite superhero character is not Superman, right? But this is really the difference between Superman and, I think, Batman. He's my favorite. Now, Superman is who? Who's Superman really?
Jesus.
He's really Jesus. Even though the Jews invented Superman also, by the way, just technically, But he really is Jesus. And it depends on the Superman. I've seen them all. Certain Superman movies depict him more Jesus-like than others. Sometimes there's like a glow around him. You know, he never curses. He never says anything wrong. Never has a bad day. His hair is perfect. He's got that little curl, you know. Here's what I don't understand about Superman. Takes off his glasses and puts on a uniform. Nobody recognizes him. I don't get that. Whatever. But it's like this, right? Think about that. Why doesn't anyone recognize Superman when he? This aside, has nothing to do with what I'm trying to share with you. It just bothers me. Anyway, he's this picture perfect specimen sent to Earth to save a race incapable of saving itself. It's Jesus. Batman's a bit of a mess. Okay, Batman. He's like the Jewish Messiah because, first of all, he has no supernatural powers. Right? He can't fly, okay? He can't burn through steel with his eyes, but he's really smart. He's got a lot of money. Okay? He uses his detective skills, he uses science, he uses technology, and here's the important part. He's got a dark side. He's got a real dark side. Right? He's not smiling all the time. I forget which Superman this was. He once took off like his bat costume, and he was like all beaten up and bruised because he just came back from like beating up the bad guys in Gotham. But like he was terribly bruised. And you know, one of the other Batman, you know, he's like kind of struggling with being like a playboy. But, you know, he's got that whole trauma, really, as a child with the bats. Because Batman is not just battling the bad guys out there in Gotham. He's also battling his inner demons. And he's got to somehow make peace with seeing his own parents killed, going through that experience as a child, and somehow the bats, he's got to turn into the thing that freaked him out so much as a kid. And he's mortal. He is really mortal. And that's why he's a very inspirational figure. Because he teaches that
you can fail, but that doesn't mean you're a failure. And I think this is why we feel so awful when we fail at something. This is just my theory. Somewhere in the back of our minds, we've internalized this idea that we're fundamentally flawed. And it gets triggered when we fail at something important. It has to be something real. It could be a test. Like in my situation, why did it make me feel so? Because obviously I was feeling not so great about myself in terms of some other things. And getting that negative, those negative test results back, it triggered it. Or it could be a diet, it could be a relationship. We imagine at those moments that we haven't simply failed in that endeavor, on that test, on that diet, in that relationship, but that fundamentally we're failures. Because if you could at that moment recognize the fact that you failed or I failed at that thing and contain it to that thing, you can deal with it. You can move on. You can brush off the dust and get back up, try again. But the idea that we're fundamentally flawed, this is not a Jewish idea. This idea does exist in Christian doctrine. It does not exist in Jewish theology, Jewish tradition. In fact, on the holiest day of the year, when we beat ourselves up the most, Yom Kippur, and by the way, I don't know how Yom Kippur became the most popular Jewish day to be in synagogue. We wonder why. This is a little harangue of mine. So few Jews keep coming back to shul when the one day of the year that they came was like they were not eating, and they were telling themselves and God how awful they are, and I'll try to do better in the coming year. Jewish guilt. Now, it is an important day, but it's only really important, well, it's only really healthy, I think, in context of other things that we do in Judaism. But there's no Jewish source anywhere in the Torah or in rabbinic tradition for a human being a sinner. We sin. We sin. But we're not sinners. We fail, but not failures. And on Yom Kippur, when we do the Ashamnu, the Bagadnu, Gazalnu, I did this wrong, I did that wrong. There was a whole list. We literally go through the whole Hebrew alphabet, all 22 letters. Aleph for Ashamnu, Bet for Bagadnu, Gimel for Gazalnu, Dalet for Dibar. These are different words referring to different sins and transgressions. We never refer to ourselves as sinners. We say we did this, and that was bad. We need to do better. And we do this. We take responsibility. We own up. But we don't say that because we did those things, that makes us total losers. And this is the only way I can understand how my favorite rabbinic figure, Rabbi Akiva, I'll stop talking in a few minutes so we can open it up for a conversation. I'm almost done. How Rabbi Akiva was able to deal with this terrible situation with the death of his 24,000 students. Any of you familiar, Rabbi Akiva was arguably one of the greatest Talmudic sages who ever lived, and he developed thousands of students. And they all died in a very short period of time. Young age, it was a terrible, like some kind of stomach epidemic, the Talmud says. And the reason that the Talmud gives for why they died is also very difficult to understand. But the Talmud says that after they all died, what did Rabbi Akiva do? Imagine his whole life work. All of his beloved students, they all die in a matter of weeks. Talmud says, he goes down to the south of Israel, he finds five new students, and he begins to teach them. Now, how did he do that? I mean, how did he not fall into like a funk and just give up? And just like, okay, I had my thousands of students, I can't do this again. And when you take into account the reason for their death, it's even more difficult to understand. The Talmud says is because shelo nehegu kavod zelazeh, that they failed to show proper respect one unto the next. What was Rabbi Akiva's main teaching in his life? Love thy neighbor. He championed the biblical phrase, v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. And all of his talmidim, his students, die because they failed to show proper respect. Now, I'm sure their failure to show proper respect was on a way higher level, sort of in concert with where they were at spiritually, and that's the only way I can understand how they'd be stricken down. But how does he continue to teach? How does he not completely see himself as an utter failure? Somehow he was able to see what happened as a terrible moment, not only for him, obviously, but in Jewish history, But that does not render the Jewish people incapable of coming back or him returning as a teacher. And therefore, he could move on. He could teach again. And this is not just pop psychology I'm giving you here. To brush off, focus on the activity and not what it says about you fundamentally. But this is a very core part of Jewish teachings. Maimonides, the great Rambam, wrote that in order for the Mashiach to come, the Messiah, he wrote that the Jewish people have to return to God. And in order for the Messiah, which is to bring the Jewish people back to God, God needs to see the Jewish people are interested in rekindling their relationship with Hashem. That's why we were sent into exile, because we let the relationship go bad. So even though the Rambam wrote that for the Messiah to come, the Jewish people have to return to God, he also said elsewhere. Same Rambam wrote in his 13 Principles of Faith that it is incumbent upon every Jew to believe in the coming of the Mashiach. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, one of the great rabbinic thinkers of the 20th century, he looks at these two Rambams and he's like, they don't make sense. They contradict each other. How could you hold both? How could the same rabbi, Maimonides, how could he say that the only way for the Mashiach to come is if all the Jews return, spiritually return, start keeping Torah and mitzvot? And it's a responsibility for every Jew to believe. It's incumbent upon you. You're being commanded to believe that the Messiah will come. Let's say the Jews don't return to God. So, how then can you believe in the coming of the Mashiach? Which he says you have to do. To be a believing Jew, you have to believe in the Mashiach. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said you can't. He said the only way you can believe in the coming of the Mashiach, according to Maimonides, is if you believe in what? Is if you believe that the Jewish people will return. If you don't believe in the capacity of your fellow Jewish brothers and sisters to live this kind of life of Torah and mitzvot, and you think Jews are just too far from it, we're too secular, we're too cynical, we don't believe. If you don't believe in that, you can't believe in the coming of the Mashiach, which is a cornerstone, foundational principle of Judaism. That Maimonides says, you have to believe in God, you have to believe that God wrote the Torah, and you have to believe that the Mashiach is going to come. But the only way the Mashiach can come is if the Jewish people return. Which is another way of saying what? That one of the 13 principles of faith is not simply faith in God. It's really faith in each other. That in order for us to believe that the Mashiach come, we have to believe that each of us could live this kind of life. And if you doubt this, ask yourself another question. If you doubt that we could all do this, then why did God give us these laws to observe? Was he setting us up for failure? It's like a teacher that gives you a test that he or she knows you can't pass. Would God ever want that? That's not the way we look at God. We look at God as a benevolent God. We don't even believe we need to have been created. The whole act of creation is considered an act of kindness on God's behalf. So if you doubt this, if you doubt that we can live this kind of life, then why does God command us to love your neighbor as yourself if you don't think it's possible? Or to give charity to the poor, or to observe the Sabbath, or to keep kosher, or any one of the 613 commandments. Why would God give us all those laws if he didn't believe us capable of observing them? The God of Judaism commands us to observe these laws because he not only thinks that they're the best thing for us, terms of our lives, personal growth and satisfaction and meaning, but he believes that we're capable of living up to them. And that's how we start our day every morning. How do we start our day? What's the prayer we say in the morning? Modeh ani lefanecha. Thank you, God, shechazarta bi nishmati, that you have returned my soul to me. Rabba umenatecha, great is your faithfulness. The last two words are a little weird. If you know your Hebrew grammar, great is your faithfulness. Usually we express we have faith in God. But what are we saying at the end of the prayer? Great is your faith in us. How do we know that God has faith in us? Because he woke us up. He got us up in the morning. And we're not here accidentally. The whole premise of Judaism is that we're here for a reason. There was a creator, There was a design. There was a purpose to all this. And so therefore, if we're awoken in the morning, it's because God believed that we could accomplish the very purpose for which we were created, or else he wouldn't have given us that day. The fact that we were given another day demonstrates God's belief that we will use our time wisely. And so when we fail, and you will, it's just a matter of time, okay? We can pick ourselves up and brush off the dust. The reason we can start over is because we know that we may have been unsuccessful at something, but that doesn't mean we're failures. And just because we sin doesn't mean we're sinners. We have a Yetzer Hara, we have an evil inclination, sometimes it gets the best of us, we have inner demons and we have struggles and challenges, but we also have guides. We've got this thing called the Torah, which is a path to follow, to live the best life, we believe. We have role models in the Torah like King David or Batman. And those people are there to inspire us to use our own abilities to overcome our obstacles and ultimately become the people we're meant to be. So, when I heard some of these ideas, I said, I'm going to take the bar again. And I finally passed. And I really never used my law degree, so I don't know what the purpose of that was. But it just killed my whole thing. But my whole point is that to succeed, we often have to fail. But just remember, that doesn't mean you're a failure. It just means you may have to approach it a little differently. It just means that it wasn't meant to be just yet. You weren't supposed to get it yet. There's something else you need to learn in order to be able to be where you want to eventually get. And that's my blessing to all of us, is to really pursue your dream, whatever it is, and to not give up. I think we're giving up way too quickly and too easily. That doesn't mean that every dream is worthy of being pursued at some point. We can talk a little about that if you'd like. But it does mean that it's not supposed to be easy. And the fact that we fail at something doesn't mean that it wasn't meant to be. So I hope that gives you a little encouragement. Thank you for listening, everyone. Okay, but questions, comments, I'd love to hear what you, rebuttals. Come join us. That's fine. You're perfect. You're good. Any comments, William? What do you got? Yeah, I see you.
A couple of years ago, Denzel Washington released the commencement speech at Penn, and he said that the failure, have something to fall back on, is one of the worst things he's ever heard. Because if you're going to fail, and you are going to fail at something in life, you shouldn't have to fall back on. You should fall forward, right? If you fall forward, you can see where you're going to land. And you can use that failure as a catalyst to build something new. So if you're going to fail forward. Don't fail backwards.
So this is really interesting. But I'm a huge fan of this, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Does he mean that you shouldn't, let's say you have a dream, because I just had this conversation with my son, who is a musician and he loves it. And I'm telling him to have a backup. Would Denzel be against that advice?
Well, I don't think it's more about having a backup. I think it's more about, like, giving up, right? So, for instance, like when someone says, oh, you shouldn't be, go to college and get your bachelor's degree, although you're going to be a world-renowned chef, just so you have something to fall back on, right? If you want to be a world-renowned chef, a college degree isn't going to be anything to fall back on, right?
But how many people here, let me just stop you here for a minute, because this is really where it comes down. How many people here would feel comfortable enough not going for a college degree, putting all your eggs in the chef basket if that's your dream, when, let's say, becoming a world-renowned chef or just a chef who can earn a living, and I don't know if that's true. Maybe it's not so hard for a chef to earn a living, but let's say it's really, really hard for a chef to earn a living. What parent, I mean, I don't know, I probably wouldn't, I'd be a little reticent to tell my son, like, you know, just, you know, forget college, just, you know.
I guess his point was that for going to fail, like just like Thomas Edison said, right? If you're going to fail, learn from the failures.
Learn from the failures, right.
So but, and in this way, if you fail forward and you use that as a stepping stone,
right.
You learn how not to do something. So use that failure as a stepping stone and not a roadblock, right?
So let me ask you guys a question, but so I totally hear that it's great advice, obviously, but do you think it's not so good to get another degree so you have that backup? If that's going to take a lot of time, energy, and money, and probably it'll make you maybe less likely to be successful if you really want to do. On the other hand, how anxiety-ridden will you be if you put too many eggs in one basket and it doesn't happen? What do you guys think? Were you going to comment on this? Yeah.
I agree with most of what you said today. The only thing that kind of irritates me in your premise was the bit about startups and about young people today and why they're afraid of failing. I don't necessarily think that the reason that startups have been decreasing with young people is because they're afraid of failing, although being afraid of failure is just generally like part of the human experience. So, like, the rest of your premise is very poignant, but just like you're encouraging your son to get a degree, because you know that the system that we're currently living in is very rigged against pursuing your dream, against pursuing something that you're passionate about, people aren't pursuing dangerous things economically because that's just the only way to survive. And like you said, right, a lot of these overnight successes don't actually
happen. But how is that different today than, let's say, 50 years ago?
Well, I mean, first off is that college debt, right? Like, the expenses of living are higher than they've ever been, and salaries are lower comparatively than they ever have been since, the last 100 years? It's really embarrassing how we are living right now economically. So, like, for the comparison to be made of, like, people aren't making, taking financial risks and building businesses from the ground up against giant monolith conglomerates like Nestle and, you know, large companies that are secretly 800 other different companies. I don't think it's because of a fear of failure. I just think it's trying to be practical.
Dealing with the current economic reality.
Right? Like, we live in a different America than people 40, 50, and 60 years old used to live in. Right? And even then, simply by the virtue of the fact that people who were 50 and 60 could afford a mortgage and buy a home, means that they now have enough equity to survive in the America that we live in today, whereas a lot of young people don't, unless if they have inherited generational wealth to a certain extent.
Except when I talk to, let's say, my parents' generation, mm-hmm. which is like maybe your grandparents' generation.
I know.
You know, I guess I'm speaking maybe in the Jewish community. We have so much more, I think, today. So I don't know if it's... I know economically things are different. I know that college is so much more relatively than what it used to be. And I don't know if people are making less than they used to. The people... I mean, this is anecdotal, because the people I speak to who are coming out of, you know, college in the 50s or 60s also came out with debt and also didn't have very good, you know, well-paying jobs out of college.
I'm saying making less comparatively to the amount of debt and expenses that a person has throughout the day. Like, even though you could have graduated with debt, maybe it would have been a couple thousand, which might have been relevant to, like, 10K modern times, whereas now people can get
Close to that 100,000,
100K if it's a private school, and that's the safe way to play it.
Right.
Right? The safe option is accrue a massive amount of debt.
No, so I hear you.
Medium paying, right? So, like, that's...
So you would tell your kids to get the other degree?
Do you
think that takes away... Do you think that takes away from the pursuing of the dream?
If I was in your position and I wanted my kid to have a fallback, I would say go get some sort of, like, certificate of manual labor, trade school or something, because that takes a lot less time, costs a lot less money,
right.
And then it doesn't require as much mental energy when you can't do your music on the side, but it's a stable job that isn't going anywhere. This is going to take a long time until we automate, like, plumbing. So, for your son in particular, right, tell him to go.
When I was in rabbinical school, one of the rabbis, he just passed away, Rabbi Tendler, used to go around and tell everybody that you should all get other degrees. And he was saying,
post-college, because you couldn't get into rabbinical school without a college degree. And he was saying, you should get another degree, because the rabbinate is not simple, and it's not easy, and if you get to a certain age, and you... He was telling us, I mean, this is 30 years ago. I heard this from him. What were we going to say?
Well, I have, I think, probably a unique perspective on this, because I was in a similar situation, I guess, as your son, and I did not finish college. And my parents were not necessarily on board with that. And it has not been easy, but things have worked out, I think, better than if I had continued on.
Interesting.
So I think, like the Edison thing where he's like, I didn't fail, I found
right.
It didn't work. The path that I was on, most people saw as the most successful. I was in business school, I was on Dean's list, I had the internship at the investment fund, all this stuff, and I was completely miserable.
Unhappy,
I knew that
right.
If I was going to be doing that, I was going to be miserable for the rest of my life.
Right.
I ended up a very different path. I worked in startups, and I'm now a professional artist of all things. None of that would have happened had I stayed on that path. And it's still not easy, and still every day I wake up and I'm able to pay my bills. I do it like I'm financially taking care of myself. But every day I wake up wondering when the other shoe's gonna drop, and what would happen if I just had that degree to fall back on, like you're saying. So I don't think it's a simple answer one way or the other.
Right.
But I think if I had continued on that path, I never would have pursued these other things that maybe what I was meant to be doing.
It's great. Thank you for sharing that. Wow. I think the answer is different for everyone.
Yeah.
It all depends how passionate you are. It depends on the field you're going into. You know?
Additionally to that, I went to school for acting, and I got a bachelor's degree in acting. And honestly, I'm like 6 months post-grad. I don't know how many months to do. It seems like it was the worst waste of my time, and I wish I could take those 4 years I spent in college studying acting and just acted instead.
Right.
And
but you don't know. I mean, in all fairness to the, you know, the system, which I'm reevaluating, especially from the perspective of a parent who has to pay college tuition. It's crazy.
It's insane.
What's that?
Plumbing school,
man. No joke.
Better than Brown.
It is like no joke. I have a friend I was in college with, and he wanted to make Aliyah. So all of a sudden, he dropped out of college, and he went into a trade school to learn plumbing and refrigeration. Like, super bright guy. And I was like, what are you doing? His name is Rob. He's like, I did my research. I want to live in Israel. I'm going to be a plumber. Because I'm going to make a lot more money as a plumber, fixing people's refrigerators and toilets, than I will be, you know, and my dream is to live in Israel. You know, my dream is, you know, and he, thank God, did very well. So, you know, it used to be, like when I grew up, it used to be like, I have to go to college. It's like, if I'm going to college, nobody can look at you like it's a big investment, like you were saying, and it's not so simple to pay it off. On the other hand, you don't want to, I will tell you just from the perspective of someone at my stage in life, you don't want to get to a place where you don't have choices. That's all. Where you don't want to, and by the way, as a Jewish person in the community, you don't want rabbis that are staying around in their jobs just because that's all they're trained to do. And someone who's in their mid-50s, where they're going to go back to school, they can't afford it at this point, so they're just going to, and unfortunately that happens, you know, to a lot of people, not just in the rabbit, in all sorts of jobs. So the versatility, I think, is very, very important. That's what I'm trying to get my kids, that each one of them should have something that they could just do if this doesn't go, like, according to plan. Because, you know, what's that expression? God plans, whatever.
Yeah.
No, man plans and God plans.
Right. Thank you.
I'm the kind of person to do more than one major. Like, I'm starting this administration and medicine. I have my plans for what I'm going into. I told you I plan on becoming a doctor of obstetrics, but that's realistic. I'm going into finance in Midtown, financial advisor.
Hashem should bless your efforts.
Thank you.
And you should give us a lot of charity. No, I understand. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, I know. Yeah, you had a point. What's your name?
David.
I'm just going to put kind of, Forest Hills? Yeah, she told us about Forest Hills. I'm from Forest Hills. Yeah.
I think in your generation, college was not the rule, it was the exception. Because there was a larger majority of Americans who were just high school degree graduates, if even that. So the exception.
Right. Not in our community, though.
No, but I mean as a whole.
As a whole, yeah. Yeah.
Now it's like 80 to 90% of people have a bachelor's degree. Therefore, going to college by itself
means so much less.
Degree inflation.
That's interesting.
So we're all wondering, okay, well, what is today's version of 1960s college? Not saying you're from the 60s, I don't know how old you are, but. And I think the answer to that is. I think the answer to that is kind of starting your own business, because America used to be like 90%, small businesses, like $1 million a year in revenue, and now it's like falling to like 34%. But I think that's kind of like something, if you look at it even like on a micro level, a dentist who graduates dental school and goes to work for a larger like corporate dental organization will make like $100K a year. Meanwhile, having their own practice is like over $1 million K, in profits. I think that's kind of the next, push your kid to whatever they do.
But you will need, to do that, you have to take some risks.
Exactly.
You're going to have to raise some capital. You're going to have to, when I started MGE, actually, I was 29, 30, and I was a rabbi in the East Side, and somebody offered me some seed money to start MGE, but he said that he would only give me the money if I only did this. I'd have to shut down all my other little hobbies, he said. I had a lot of hobbies. And he wasn't offering me all the money either. He was offering me 15% of the first year's budget, 20% maybe. It was all donations, it's like all non-for-profit. But it was difficult because he was really forcing me to choose. But he's a big believer that you're not going to be successful, and this is the point I'm trying to make, unless you have enough skin in the game. That's why this particular donor is a big supporter of Chabad, Lubavitch. Why does he like Chabad so much? Because Chabad rabbis, whether you like them, you don't like them, they're in. They're all in. They go to a community, and this is the old joke, they buy a plot, in a cemetery. They ain't moving. This is where they're going to be. And they have a lot of skin in the game, and you're much more likely to be successful when you just see yourself doing that.
Look at you now. This is great.
Thank you.
Do you know the phrase burn the ships?
Yeah.
Yeah, so when Cortes came to Mexico, he actually went back overnight and burned all of his crewmates' ships, and they were like, we're conquering or we're dying. There's no more.
By the way, there's a terrible story in Jewish history like that when there was a debate. It's in the Talmud between the rabbis who wanted to make peace with the Romans and a group of what was called Baryonim. They were like more right-wing zealots. And they didn't want to let anyone negotiate a peace settlement with the Romans. The Jews were living like a vassal state before the destruction of the Second Temple. So they burnt down the storehouses in Jerusalem that could have kept the Jews afloat for decades while they were negotiating some sort of peace, a long-term peace negotiation with the Romans. So anyway, that's using that in a really bad way. But there is something to be said about like really throwing yourself into it. Yeah, somebody else here?
Yeah, you said we are here for some reason, and I totally agree with you. I'm here for a reason. I saw a topic you're talking today. I'm being Syria affiliate. I feel like I'm a loser. I'm an Asian, and the stereotype is Asian always straight A. Yes, I'm a straight A student. I feel this fine. I get pretty bad, and the professor had to talk to me that we should continue or not. So I started to take a leave. I know you couldn't speak up. You wouldn't do that. So yeah, I really want to be a economist.
Are you in SIPA now?
I'm in GSAS.
Oh, very, sorry.
understanding science, I guess. But I can't, if I gave up now, I would never be the person I want to be. But during this conversation, the professor and I think I'm not capable to do this anymore. So I decided to take a leave of absence to explore myself and trying to build up my confidence.
Well, that's probably a very good idea, but I hope you I hope you don't give up just because one professor, you know, it didn't go right with one course or one professor, you know. And I hope you also don't I hope you're not too hard on yourself because you made a comment about, you know, sort of Asians in general are seen as so smart and therefore you have to live up to some kind of perfect standard. You know, we have a lot of that in our people too.
Yeah, I know,
Drew.
That's why I'm here.
We have way too much of that, and it's very counterproductive. It's not healthy, and it's not very Jewish, believe it or not, even though a lot of Jews seem to practice that, meaning we have very high expectations of ourselves. So that's a very, you know, it's a very delicate thing, because you want to shoot for the stars, but you don't want to have such a high expectation that, you know, you feel like such a loser,
yeah,
in not accomplishing that, you know. So I think it's good that you're still thinking it over. I wouldn't throw in the towel. We can talk offline privately if you'd like, just to see if I can be of any help. But you know, sometimes it can take a few tries. I mean, I don't think there's any. Can anyone think of any overnight success that didn't have to really, you know?
Like 90% of them are already, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
Yeah. There are people that invest their money instead of their time. Some people don't want to be employed, they like to be self-employed.
Okay, all right. I mean, you know.
No, you just have to make sense.
Right, right.
I think it was Picasso, I might be making up this, who the quote came from, but he said something like, there's no such thing as an appearance. They said to him, how did you become such an overnight success? He said, I'm not an overnight success, I'm 30 years and one night success.
Right.
So like, there's a lot of things that happen before you get noticed.
Everybody thought, by the way, I'm a crazy Beatles fan, so like everybody thought this about the Beatles because they were so young when they were on the Ed Sullivan show, and they were in their early 20s, like 21, 22, 20. But they've been playing together since they were 14, 15. Now, I know that sounds like, oh, big deal. But they all gave up all of their schools. They all dropped out to the chagrin of all their parents. And they were all really good because they were smart dudes. They were all very doing well. And they gave up a tremendous amount. And they played for years these terrible pubs in Germany and people throwing beer at them and just like up till 3 a.m. and popping. It was just like not a good life for a long time. But we only see them when they're nice, you know, clean and squeaky on Ed Sullivan show in 1964. And everybody just thought like they must have just rolled out of bed. But actually, who's the writer who wrote Outliers? Malcolm Gladwell. But he wrote another book where he talked about, not in Outliers, it's called the 10,000 Hour Rule.
Tipping Point,
yeah.
It was a trilogy of books. That
were, yeah, so he wrote, and he said basically, I don't know, he generalized, but generally speaking, it's about a 10,000 hour investment for anyone who's really become like. Now, of course, there are many people in the world that put those 10,000 hours in and don't become those successes, okay? But, you know, success also doesn't have to mean that you're a world-renowned economist. It could mean that you are a good economist and you can earn a living doing this and you're helping people in your own way, but it's not like, you know, things don't have to blow up to be successful.
But how do you look at that and not think that you failed?
Because it all depends what your goals are. It all depends what your goals are. Like,
what if the goal is that?
I mean, listen, we have how many beautiful crowd here, 20-something people in the room. So if my goal was to have a program where hundreds of people become in the class, this is one big failure. MGE, one big failure. That's a good tagline, right? It all depends on, like, what you have to have realistic goals for what you want to accomplish. Now, you also don't want to sell yourself too short. That's why it's tricky. It's tricky. You have to assess what's realistic and then shoot a little further. It's like the gym a little. And if you can pump a certain amount of weight, and then you like, well, I should be able to do much more, you're going to get hurt. But if you don't push it a little more out of your comfort zone, you're not going to break a sweat, and you won't have accomplished anything in the gym either. So it's a very, you know, it says in the Ethics of Our Fathers, Lefum, it's a famous line in Hebrew, Lefum Tzara Agra, which is Aramaic for, according to the tsar, which really means the stress. Tsar is stress. According to the stress is the agra, is the reward. It's no pain, no gain. Right? But again, I think social media is a really awful gauge, and I'm affected by it also. We all are. It's a very poor gauge of success, because there's a lot of superficialities. There are a lot of people who are buying names and likes, and there's a lot of shenanigans going on that aren't real in the world of Instagram and Facebook. And I'm not saying that everybody who's famous bought their names and they're all not legit. It's not true. But just because someone blew up on social media doesn't mean they've become a success necessarily. Now, it's helpful. It's helpful, especially if that's the end goal. But for most people, it's just a tool. It's just a means for something greater. I think that's how you help control social media, is to look at it as a tool, not the end of itself, which is definitely challenging for YouTubers, for people who are literally earning their living and their whole end-all be-all on YouTube or other, you know, platforms and social media. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it could wreak havoc on your sense of self. Yeah?
So, here's my question, because let's take musicians like an example here, right? There's partially a true school of thought that if you split too much attention between school or between becoming a plumber or between whatever you want to do and actually honing your craft as a musician and really pursuing it and being able to get thrown beer to your face and clubs and whatever, then to an extent, you're never going to completely succeed because you're too comfortable with that idea. Like, you need to push yourself past that point, right? But then on the other hand, this might just be the circles that I run in, but I know a lot of guys who are way too old to still be making songs on SoundCloud.
Right.
And, like, in my opinion, I feel like they should have thrown in the towel by now. But to that end, I'm one of the naysayers. I'm one of the people saying, you're giving up, increasing that negativity, right? And having people not believe in themselves. So how long is too long? This is not a fruitful endeavor.
Right. Well, so first of all, I would never, if it's a passion, here's what I would say. If it's a passion, then you never throw it out. It's just a question of how much you relegate it to the side. How much does it no longer become your main means of livelihood? Because you do have a responsibility, according to Jewish tradition, to earn a living. And if you're going to try to have a family, you know, it says it in the ketubah, that the man gives his wife, I'm going to take care of you. Okay, now it works both ways, thankfully, today. That's a good thing, I think. But there is a responsibility to earn a living. But to give up a passion, an artistic or other kind of passion, I think is really giving up a part of yourself. And I would never ask anyone ever to do that. And I don't think anyone should ever do that. Having said that, a good friend will look at the person and say, you need to move on. You're not making enough money with your passion. So my advice would be to start putting some more time into something that you may not be as excited or passionate about, but will earn you money. And then you can still do that in some other capacity.
But isn't that engaging in the backup plan to an extent?
You need to. I think you need to. I think that's being a responsible adult.
You gave the example of music. So I'm a musician by nature, but that would be a side hustle. I couldn't have lived off music. Unless I got a contract somewhere.
Right, I understand. So you need it's not being at a certain point when you gave it. It's called in Hebrew hishtadlut, or it sounds better to say like hishtadlus. What's your hishtadlus? Hishtadel in Hebrew means to effort, to put your effort in, to try. You have to put hishtadlus into. How do you know when to give up on a relationship? Well, when you feel you put your best foot forward and it's not moving forward, you say, I did my best I could. It's not meant to be.
Same thing with a musical ambition or professional aspiration. That's just not earning you the livelihood that you need to live like a normal human being. And if that's the case, you never throw out, you know, that passion that you have, but you can no longer look at it as a basis for your means of survival in this world. And that requires a certain maturity to be able to do. And I think that it's... And not doing that, failing to do that, is really failing to live up, you know, just to be an adult member of society and have a home, you know. But that doesn't mean you have to be rich unless you really want that, you know. But at some point, if it's not earning you a living, that's the point when, you know, when you can't do it anymore. Or even before that point, if the person's uncomfortable putting too much of their efforts into something that's not bringing them financially what they need. Now, having said that, you could go to the other extreme and just keep going. Too many people in the world are just miserable with what they're doing. They're just unhappy people. If you want to read a book about this, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. He was talking about Holocaust survivors, but he also helped a lot of very depressed people get out of their careers and find something more meaningful for their lives. Because we spend so many waking hours just trying to earn a living. If you're so miserable in what you're doing, you need to look at that too. You know, I do think there's a lot of pressure. And by the way, I'll say something else, and I don't want to shoot myself in the foot. There's no mitzvah to live in New York City in one of the most expensive towns in the country. In other words, there might be other reasons you want to live here, but no one said you had to make that amount of money to be able to live in such an expensive place. And the only way to do that is to give up on my dream and do something I have no interest in so I can continue to live in some place that costs so much money. What's that? We opened up here because there's so many of you. You know, there's just so many young Jewish professionals here. Yeah. But it's a personal, it's a difficult decision. And
they want the acres of land, they don't want the city anymore. Like, I'm that kind of person eventually, maybe after I'm married, to live on a ranch. You know, I don't know, nature, like suburban or even rural.
So I originally wanted to get a doctorate from SIPO.
Okay.
And my professor in college said to me that you're probably not going to be able to earn a decent living with a doctorate for the same amount of education, get a master's and a law degree. And he had been out in the field for many, many years. He was doing things I was interested in doing. And he said, if I could do it all over again, I get a master's and a law degree and not a PhD.
Is that sustainable?
I'm sorry?
Is that sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends. Like, I knew I needed to earn a certain amount of money, and he was telling me it's going to be very, very difficult to do that just with the doctorate alone. I mean, it sounds ridiculous. PhD is not going to earn you enough money. But it doesn't. It's we all know that.
You know the joke about PhD, right?
I'm sorry?
You know the joke about PhD.
Tell us.
Pop as though,
okay. Yeah, you got to be able to sustain yourself in school for long enough. Yeah, listen, this is a very personal decision. But the point, I think the broad strokes that we're establishing here is that... is that you should shoot for your dreams. And if you can't really earn a living and accomplish your dreams, figure something else out, have a backup, but then still... I just also believe metaphysically and spiritually that our dreams and our passions and sometimes our artistic inclinations are part of who we are. And denying that is really denying a big, you know... On the other hand, continuing at that and making believe that you can earn a living doing it when you see you can't, is being very responsible at the same time. So you have to balance those two things.
I think there's one interesting example. I forget the guy's name. He's the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he is a touring DJ along with being CEO.
There you go.
And so obviously he's very financially successful in his main career, but I wonder if he didn't have this other thing that he was doing, if he would feel very successful if he shut that part of himself off.
Yeah, that's really, really important. Yeah, Viktor Frankl, you should read this book, everyone. Man's Search for Meaning. We will send it out in a little bibliography. It's an amazing, amazing piece. And
He just said that purpose and meaning is no different than oxygen. Just like we need oxygen to breathe, we need purpose and meaning. You know, he tells a very dramatic story when he was in the camps of one of his bunkmates who had this reoccurring dream that on a certain night they were going to be liberated from the camps. And that night came and went, and unfortunately they were not liberated, and the man died in his sleep. And he said that for all intents and purposes, he died of typhus, which is unfortunately what a lot of Jews come to in the camps, but that he believed he died then because of a lack of hope, of what he really wanted to live for. And that's a very, very important thing. But also, I want to mention one last thing, and that is we don't also put all of our eggs in the purpose meaning basket based on our professions. That's another kind of lie that we've been fed, right? Religion, spirituality is very, very important. Relationships. You know, there are a lot of people who don't really love their jobs at all, but they're very happy because they don't live for their jobs. They live for their families, or they live for their relationship with Hashem, the Torah, the mitzvot. They have other things going on. So Judaism in general, if you get really attached to your Torah, you'll never get sucked in so much to your profession to the exclusion of, you know, if you're really devoted to being, you know, Jewish in this sense. Because it requires mitzvah observance, it requires Torah study, it requires coming to classes like this and really growing yourself spiritually. That helps produce happiness even if you have a dead-end job. And I'm not saying to get a dead-end job, but it helps with it, with that kind of job. All right, next week we're going to continue with, sexuality, a little different topic. The unique Jewish perspective on sex, that's what I'll be talking about next week. The following Monday night, we're going to be doing a little interesting talk with Rabbi Shmuley Botach, who's a really interesting rabbinic personality. And who's the third? What's her name? Erin Davis, who is a professional matchmaking coach. So we're going to have a whole talk about meeting. Meeting and greeting. What is it called? What are we calling it? Do you know?
Create the spark like the match.
Create the spark like the match. I don't know, something with a flame. I don't know, falling in love, something like that. So next week is sex and then love. I guess it's backwards. We should have done it the other way around first. Okay. Any other questions or comments just about this? Anyone else feel like a loser? Just want to say that. Just kidding. Just kidding. All right. Guys, thank you all. Let's go around. No. I appreciate you guys being here. Thank you for coming. And there's some excellent cold pizza if you'd like to continue to have some. Have a great night, everyone. Oh, by the way, just so you know, Friday nights, we always have FNL here, Friday Night Lights at 6:30. And we have services Saturday morning at 9:30. You're all welcome to come. We have a great kiddush in this room, beautiful community. And yeah, thanks for coming. Yeah.